to tackle these beliefs, or, you know, indeed whether we should. If there are some conspiracy theories that we should just let it be, let people believe what they want to believe, or with other ones like the anti-vaccine or the anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, what we can do to persuade people that they're wrong. Thinking about confirmation bias, it makes dissuading people of their conspiracy beliefs particularly problematic. Because as soon as we start telling somebody that, you know, the evidence goes against their conspiracy theory, well, that's exactly what they would expect to hear if they believed the theory, because they would expect that the conspirators would be putting out disinformation designed to mislead them.
Well, finally, Rob, how do I know that you've not been put up to writing this book by maybe the Illuminati or the Freemasons as part of their scheme to control the world?
I would have asked for a much bigger book advance from the Illuminati.
Rob Brotherton, thank you so very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Rob Brotherton is a psychologist, an adjunct assistant professor at Barnard College, and the author of Suspicious Minds, Why We Believe Conspiracy Theories.
No, what we've heard in the show, fear. We love it. We hate it. It keeps us alive, obviously, but it also tempts us to explore, to take risks, kind of the yin and yang of fear. But when we feel fearful without wanting to, when world events give me goosebumps, we can all too quickly look for a deeper explanation, not the devil, as we would have said 1,000 years ago, but maybe a secret group of people conspiring to do us harm.
Well, it's something to keep in mind when we think about how fear and fear of conspiracy is used to shape our opinions and even influence our policy.
I'm back, and you'll be glad that I am. You think that my talk of shadow producers running this show is crazy? Well, I have proof. This guy Brotherton talks a lot about conspiracy, but these aren't theories. They're actual plots. But the one you didn't hear him mention is the most disturbing of them all, because it's happening right now and they don't want you to know about it. It's the presence of intergalactic lizards among us. Oh, Brotherton slipped and mentioned it, but then the shadow producers edited it out. Luckily, I rescued the clip. Check this out.
You know, for the most part, conspiracy theories, they aren't proposing anything that kind of contradicts, you know, mainstream physics. There's nothing inherently that couldn't be true. Until you start getting to theories like about intergalactic lizards and stuff like that. But I think they're in a different class. I think for the most part, conspiracy theories could be true, but they exist on this spectrum of plausibility.
You didn't hear about the intergalactic lizards in the interview, did you? Why would they take that out unless the shadow producers were hiding the truth that they don't want you to know? And that's that lizards and other reptiles travel between galaxies, which he says violates mainstream physics. But I happen to know that he's wrong, my friend, and not just because I've done the trip myself. I read about it online. Being cold-blooded gives reptiles the edge in space travel. See, they don't have to heat the rocket. Huh? Think about it. So they're among us. Either disguised as Earth lizards or humans. Either way, the shadow producers, who are in cahoots with the they that they don't want you to know about, don't want you to know about it. But I've got it all written down. Oh, I gotta go.
Thanks to the shady characters who helped produce this show, we can only theorize how they do it. Gary Niederhoff and Barbara Vance.
Also, thanks to financial support from Rena Shulsky David and Sammy David. Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, where scientists study the origin and nature of life. And a big thanks also to our listeners.
Your ears have been attuned to our monthly look at critical thinking, Skeptic Check. This episode, Fear Itself. If you'd like to hear more Skeptic Check or other Big Picture Science episodes, you'll find them in our archive at bigpicturescience.org.
And if you're a podcast listener, but you prefer listening to over-the-air radio, because after all, it's less susceptible to being tracked by the black helicopters, well, check out the listing on our website of radio stations that carry the program. And if your local station is not on that list, consider letting them know you like the show.
And do you have a comment, a criticism, or a suggestion for us? Well, throw in some faint praise and then email it all to bigpicturescience@seti.org.
Uh-oh, here comes Seth. Gotta hide the evidence.
Gary, you've got to stop this. You've got to stop with the conspiracy theories about shadow producers, intergalactic lizards, okay?
What? I wasn't doing anything.
Skeptic Check is brought to you thanks to a generous grant from the Trimberger Family Foundation. At the Trimberger Family Foundation, we hold that skepticism is a lamp that lights the way to truth. Trimberger.org.
What's up? It's your girl, Neek Love Rhodes, and you are listening to WHFR Dearborn.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Africa, Africa stirs in my blood. Africa, Africa churns and burns in my soul. Africa, the light of my spirit.
Lift every voice and sing, till earth and heaven ring, ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise high as the listening skies. Let it resound loud as the rolling sea. Sing a song.
Life in your 20s is a precarious time filled with wonderment and uncertainty. You're officially an adult and you're expected to have life all mapped out, making all the right moves, but you're simply trying to find your voice. Whether it's amid the hustle and bustle of the workplace or the deafening chorus of voices on social media, in your 20s, you're simply trying to find your voice. Within your family, your community, and your friends, someone might be trying to find that voice during the holidays, because we all want our voices filled with hope, dreams, and aspirations to be heard, shared with those we love. After entering college at Clark Atlanta University at the age of 16, becoming the first African-American to pass the Florida bar exam, and taking part in what historians call the Great Migration to the North, this 20-something-year-old was well on his way to having his voice. By all accounts, he made all the right moves and finally found his voice and was ready to be heard. But after returning from his first mission trip to Haiti, a young James Weldon Johnson knew that it was not only his voice, but the collective voice of all who wanted to work towards living and experiencing the notion of all men are created equal. A voice of justice, a voice of harmony, a voice of liberty. A resounding voice that would provoke the ears of a listening God himself. After seeing and experiencing the reality of an America divided, a 20-something-year-old sacrificed his well-deserved singular voice when he sat down and penned the poem, Lift Every Voice and Sing, a poem that his brother later set to music and is referred to as the Negro National Anthem. It speaks of our heritage and history of African Americans. It speaks to the pains and the triumphs and the opportunities and challenges that we face in our country. It speaks of a voice that needs to be heard through all generations, that we must stay true to our God and true to our native land.
To our God, true to our native land.
Peace and blessings. Alafia. I welcome you all to A Season's Griot. I am your host, Madafo. A Season's Griot is a Kwanzaa public radio program brought to you in the tradition of our African ancestry and in the spirit of the African-American Kwanzaa celebration. With storytelling, poetry, and music, the rich history of a people is presented. This year, our special guests are two of the finest storytellers in the world, Charlotte Blake Alston from the great city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and Baba Jamal Karam, also known as the Story Man. They have come to lend their voices to the spirit of a people, and we welcome you, all of you, to A Season's Griot 2016. Here is a wonderful Kwanzaa story written by Baba Jamal Karam, the Story Man.
Grandmama always carried a piece of cloth of African fabric with she. It wasn't always the same kind of cloth. Sometimes it was a large piece of bogolofini. Some people call that mud cloth. Other times it was a wonderful, colorful piece of kente cloth, or maybe it was also ashoke cloth or kuba cloth, but she always had a piece of African fabric with her, with she. Little grandchild said, "Why, Grandmama? Why you always carry that cloth with you? Why you always look funny with all that cloth around you and on you and hanging out of your pockets?" Grandmama laughed. "Because we forget too easy, son. Every generation we must lose, or we do lose a little bit more of us. This cloth lets me know that we can lose our language, or we can lose our clothes, our color, and even our minds, but we must never lose our memory of who we are and what has been left to us by the ancestors. Do you understand?" The boy nodded his head and then asked the grandmother, "What did our ancestors leave us, Grandmama?" "See this bogolofini cloth, son? Sometimes we call it mud cloth, 'cause it used to be made in mud by the free-flowing rivers of Africa, in the mineral-rich lands of our motherland. Our ancestors left us land. Even when we came over here, our foremothers and fathers saw to it that we had some land. Bogolofini cloth reminds us, that we must have and keep land. See this kente cloth? It was worn by royalty. Those who looked out for the best interests of our people, royalty like Nzinga. Do you know Nzinga, son?" "No, Grandmama." "You will." "Or Sunjata." I know Sunjata. That's good." "Or Solomon, or Makeda, Pianke, any one of a number of queens and kings that left us political leadership, left us courage, left us governmental organization and the power of being a people. Do you understand?" "I think I do, Grandmama. Each piece of cloth holds another part of our heritage that was left to us by our ancestors. And look, see this cotton cloth? Well, I'm going to tell you about that. But what you need to know before I explain that is that what we wear has meaning. It shows who we are. It shows whether we're leaders or followers, whether we're righteous, whether we're strong or weak, whether we're spiritual. And our ancestors on this side of the water planted and picked cotton. Bales and bales of cotton. Clothes are made from this wonderful fabric. And that's why I carry it. That's why I carry the cotton, so that we don't forget what we have done on this side. Do you understand, son? I do, Grandmama, I do. The grandmother and the son, they sat for a minute. And then the boy said, Grandmama, out of all the things you say, what I most remember is that cotton was left by those Africans here in America. And they were strong and they produced strong cotton, and I must be strong. And the grandmother smiled. The grandmother gave me this piece of cloth, and I gave you this story.
Kwanzaa is an American holiday celebration that pays tribute to the rich cultural roots of Americans of African descent and ancestry. The word Kwanzaa comes from the East African language of Kiswahili and means the first or the first fruits of the harvest. Kwanzaa is a 7-day celebration observed from December 26 until January the 1st. Kwanzaa is unique because it is neither a religious, political, nor heroic holiday celebration, but rather a cultural one, which speaks to the relevance of family, principles and values, and the proper nurture of the community. At its core, Kwanzaa is based on 7 fundamental principles of living, referred to as the Nguzo Saba. Nguzo Saba, which means in the Kiswahili language, 7 principles. The first day of Kwanzaa is Umoja, which means unity in the East African language of Kiswahili. To strive for and maintain unity in the family, community, the nation, and race. Umoja is a principle of strength and honesty. And for the other 6 Nguzos to be effective, Umoja must be a working element at its core. It was the spirit of Umoja racing through every African-American community when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. sent out the call for more than 200,000 people to join him that bright, sunshiny day at the Lincoln Memorial. It was like the drum call traditionally uniting the people, calling out to them to take action, and they did.
Kujichagulia means self-determination, to define ourselves, name ourselves, create for ourselves and speak for ourselves instead of being defined, named, created for and spoken for by others. And during the season of Kwanzaa, which is year-round, but particularly in the winter months, we reflect. We take time to rest, knowing that the journey in front of us is still demanding. It was Kujichagulia, self-determination, to define ourselves, speak for ourselves, instead of being defined and spoken for by others. It was Kujichagulia. On the second day of Kwanzaa, my people raised their faces to the skies to celebrate Kujichagulia, to speak, name, define, defend, and uplift ourselves. You see, it was Kujichagulia that allowed Sangbe and more than 50 others to return home to Sierra Leone after fighting for their freedom. You do remember Miss Angbe, you do remember the Amistad. You see, it was Kuji Chakalia that made Akinyele Nat Turner rise up on a August morning to educate, agitate, organize our people to fight for their freedom and land. You do recall Akinyele Nat down there in Southampton County, Virginia. Sat by Cabin Pond one day and realized that now was the time to fight for freedom, to keep freedom, and to keep freedom in the minds and hearts of his people. It was Kuji Chakalia that made Araminta Harriet Tubman release her people, release our people from bondage, like Brother Moses did long, long time before her. That's why they called her Moses. It was Kuji Chakalia that way over in South Africa allowed Stephen Biko to pave the road for freedom for the people of Azania, South Africa, with truth talking and righteous walking and bold movement. It was Kuji Chakalia, self-determination, that made Fannie Lou Hamer fight for voting rights, that made Angela Davis fight for political prisoners, that made Rosa Parks sit down, that made El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz, Malcolm X stand up, that made Marcus Garvey build and organize, that allowed Queen Mother Moore and Dara Abu Bakari to organize and challenge, that allowed Maulana Karanga to create, develop, and promote Kwanzaa. It was Kuji Chakalia that made 400,000 black men and black women join the Union Army to defeat the enemies of freedom for them, the enemies of freedom and land, justice and dignity. So on this day, this second day of Kwanzaa, we remember these millions and other Africans who spoke out, who named and who defined and who defended and uplifted African people worldwide. On this day, we remember all of the families who have reared their children to be the kind of people our ancestors would be proud of. Let us continue. Let us continue to learn about Kwanzaa. Let us continue to celebrate Kwanzaa. And let us continue to practice Kwanzaa, Kuji Chakalia, self-determination. Kuji Chakalia, self-determination.
So when I think about this principle of Kwanzaa, Kuji Chakalia, self-determination, it always kind of takes me back to our roots here, and our presence here on American soil is essentially rooted in the pathology of oppression and systemic dehumanization. So that all claims to any individual, familial, ethnic, or collective human identities were literally beaten out of the first and subsequent waves of African peoples brought to these shores. And that was a practice that continued for over 200 years. And the remnants of that practice of degradation continue to manifest in multiple ways even today. Someone else defined us, someone else named us, someone else falsified our origins and fed that to us, our history, our cultural sensibilities, and displaced them with weak and flawed myths. Someone else assigned us an artificial subhuman status. So it is critical that we seek to learn and understand the truth of our past, that we take the initiative to acknowledge all that we've achieved in the face of constant obstacles, that we define ourselves, that we set goals and prepare our children to stand strong and move forward with the given that obstacles will continue to be placed in their path. We must tell our children and all of America's children that the true stories of our history, both ancient and contemporary, throughout the diaspora, and through examples that can be found right within our own communities of the greatness, the creativity, and the resilience of our people. We must remain diligent, politically aware, and unapologetically vocal and active to ensure that no individual or group can ever lay claim to us or have control over us, over our lives, over our history, over how our story is told, over our collective strength, our achievements, our future, or our destiny here in the land of the free.
The third principle of Kwanzaa is Ujima, collective work and responsibility. To build and maintain our community together and make our sisters and brothers' problems our problems and to solve them together. This principle causes flashbacks to a time in my childhood when the great spirit of life saturated the African-American community. Black men and black women stood tall in every facet of the community then, doing that which had to be done, raising the children, the coming generations, in the tradition. In my 7-year-old self, something stirred as I watched neighbors taking care of one another with the same love and affection of blood kin. We were all poor, but no one went without. If one had, everybody had. The fourth principle of Kwanzaa is Ujamaa. Ujamaa, cooperative economics, to build and maintain our own stores and other businesses and profit from them together. Growing up in Wilmington, North Carolina, afforded me all kinds of opportunity to immerse myself within Ujamaa. I was a shoeshine boy. Hey, mister, shine your shoes for a quarter, nickel for a dust off. Every Saturday morning, all up and down North 4th Street, farmers, angels in overalls, came, set up their booths and stalls filled with freshly picked fruits and vegetables. Everybody was there, in and out of the cafes and clothing stores, from the hipster with his broad-brimmed hat cocked to the side, to Mrs. Margaret Johnston, looking to purchase her fresh vegetables for the week, to Reverend Peterson's pretty wife and their three little girls, all dressed up in dainty patent leather shoes and pink-laced socks. The street was filled with cars, parked and moving slowly up and down the crowded main drag. And the sounds were unmistakably the perfect African symphonic background. Car horns beeping, Greek cafe owners chasing the shoeshine boys from the entrances. There were friends greeting one another. It was Ujamaa in full complexity. The community had no reason to believe otherwise. We just didn't have a name for it. Africa was an ocean away, and the closest we could get was Tarzan at the Ritz Theater. It only cost a nickel for 2, sometimes 3 main features, 5 shorts, an episode of the Three Stooges, and a weekly newsreel. But things do change, and change is inevitable.
The fifth principle is Nia. Nia in the Kiswahili language means purpose. It is doing what needs to be done. It is any creative or helpful action that glorifies life in our search for happiness. It is preserving and increasing the legacy that the ancestors left us. Dr. Benjamin May says, every man is born into the world to do something unique and something distinctive, and if he or she does not do it, it will never be done.
The sixth principle of Kwanzaa is Kuumba, which means creativity. To do as much as we can in the way we can, in order to leave our community more beautiful and beneficial. An African people built the pyramids, charted the universe, created the sciences and contemplated world peace. World peace. World peace.
The seventh principle of Kwanzaa is imani, which means faith in the language of Kiswahili. To believe with all our heart in our Creator, our people, our parents, our teachers, our leaders, and the righteousness and victory of our struggle. We begin with a belief in the Creator. And for those of us who believe, we are thankful for the goodness of all creation. Traditions teach us that we are all created in the image of the Creator. We are each, therefore, capable of great faith in ourselves. Mary McLeod Bethune. She was a great civil rights leader and educator. Founded a school in Daytona Beach, Florida, Bethune-Cookman University. She, at the age of 12, began to kneel down in the fields and pray for an opportunity for more education. She had faith that her prayer would be answered. Mary McLeod Bethune's last will and testament states, "I leave you love. I leave you hope. I leave you the challenge of developing confidence in one another. I leave you a thirst for education. I leave you a respect for the uses of power. I leave you faith. Faith in God is the greatest power, but great too is faith in one's self."
We'll be right back with more of A Season's Griot from PRI, Public Radio International. Listening to A Season's Griot from PRI, Public Radio International. Charlotte Blake Alston tells this wonderful African story as only she can. Here is Nonikwe, taken from the great epic Indaba, My Children, written by Vusama Zulu Credo Mutwa. Yele bakanje uluzwa, aji. Achkumayele.
Chileton se unga pangingati, palile chikondi, palibewa chita.
There was no joyous celebration when Nonikwe was born. I do not mean to say that the pregnancy was not received with great joy. I do not mean to say that her birth was not anticipated. Her father, Lusu, boasted loudly and often as his wife's belly began to rise. Sons, of course, were preferred, but far more important even to Lusu, the headman, the Nduna of his village, was a healthy offspring, In this time not so long ago and not so far away, it was not understood nor accepted that the gender of a child was determined by its father's genetic material. In this time and in this place, it was the woman who bore the responsibility of producing a male or female child. Her value to her husband, to her family, to his, was often determined by the children she produced. Nonikwe's mother, Sikilela, had no trouble conceiving, and her pregnancy was uneventful. And little Nonikwe emerged with a thick blanket of jet black curly hair. Her eyes blinked in the darkened room of the birthing hut. She opened them just enough for the midwife to see in the center of each eye a round, gray, filmy disc. This one would be blind. When her body had fully emerged, the midwife's face changed. The infant's most pronounced feature was a large deformity on her upper back. But her cry was strong. It announced to the world, "I am here." Before long, the sound of her hopeful wail swelled to include the mournful voices of the midwife, the mother, and the grandmothers. It was difficult to tell whether Lucy's reaction was disappointment or anger. "A hunchback child. You give to me a hunchback child? This child cannot be mine. She cannot be mine." Now, I am sorry to tell you that in this time not so long ago, and this place not so far away, babies with deformities were believed to have been conceived and possessed by a demon intent on doing harm in the village. These vulnerable ones were taken a distance away and left to a disturbing fate in the open bush or the grasslands. But here, God be praised, if indeed this was something to be grateful for, it was the custom that all children with deformities or crippling infirmities were allowed to live at least 8 years in order to see if they might have any special gifts. Nonikwe had a greater chance than many. The midwife took note that when the little one was born, small bits of membrane clung to her head and face, not completely covering it like a caul, but enough to make them wonder, is this one bearing a gift? Lusu openly rejected his wife and daughter, and while the child was still a suckling infant, he drove them out of the village. Sikilela sought refuge in the village of her brother, Mutengu. Mutengu reacted in anger as well, but not because he was repelled by the little one, but by the hardness of Lusu's heart. But from the time of her arrival, little Nonikwe was treated like a chieftainess. She became the most precious and most well-protected soul there. For it was not long before her gifts were revealed. She had abilities even beyond the healers. Nonikwe had the gift of seeing events and sometimes revealing the details before they even happened. As the years passed, and Nonikwe grew slightly in stature but greatly in wisdom, news of her gifts began to spread. Lusu, her father, too, heard of her gifts and began to make moves to get Nonikwe back. Mutengu refused. It was his sister's dying wish that the child should never fall into the hands of her father. For this reason, Lusu's heart became even harder. He declared Mutengu his enemy and began to publicly accuse him of all kinds of indiscretions, corruption, and breaches of the laws of the land and the people. All of these accusations were false. But Lusu would travel on a regular basis to make reports to the great Marimba. Ah, Marimba, the great one, they called her. In that time and place, there was no one more revered than the great marimba. She was a musician, instrument maker, singer, a healer, a teacher. She was the great princess of the Wahambi people. She lived to bring happiness. She resolved disputes that could not be resolved by village chiefs. Given all that she had been told by Lusu, Marimba decided to go to Mutengu's village to find out for herself if the reports were true. Her visit, though, would be in secret. She would go disguised. But she had forgotten about little Nanikwe. The little one woke up early that day. She had had a dream the night before, and in the dream, Marimba's plans were revealed. She warned her uncle to expect a secret visit from his queen sometime in the afternoon. Mutengo was startled, but acted quickly, for the little girl's predictions had never been wrong. He ordered scouts to be posted at each road that led into the village so they could warn him of the approach of the great queen and her retinue. The women began cooking large quantities and varieties of foods for a welcome feast fit for one such as she. Mutengo had no secrets to hide. He was loyal to his people, worked hard, and was a popular headman. If needed, many volunteered to step forward publicly to vouch for his kindness, his courage, his honesty, his integrity, and were prepared to defend him against any scandal. The food was laid out in clay pots and bowls. The villagers settled down to await the arrival of one who did not know she was already expected. Mutengo dressed himself in a simple garment of hyena skin. He waited to greet his queen. But the smells of the food were intoxicating. People from nearby villages followed their noses and came to share the free food, tell some good, not true tales, and join in the excitement that a feast brings. By early afternoon, the place was teeming with people. At about midday, a very old and very tired-looking man came into the village. He was accompanied by his beautiful daughter and inquired at the gate if he might be allowed to spend the night, for they had traveled a long distance and needed to rest. Visitors and requests such as this were not unusual, and the guards were happy to admit them. They were offered food and encouraged to eat their fill. The rest of the afternoon was taken up with normal activities. There was still plenty to eat as the sun began to set behind the mountains, but still, the queen of the Wahambi had not arrived. A small doubt began to gnaw in the back of Mutengu's mind. He began to wonder if, for the first time, his precious niece had been wrong in her prophecy. He walked over to her small hut and knelt down beside her, holding her hand gently and reassuringly. He spoke to her. "Little one, I think perhaps for once the spirits have played a trick on you, for the Queen Marimba has not come." Oh, but she has, uncle. The Queen of the Wahambi is here. I can feel the pulse of her thoughts." "Well, my scouts have brought no news of her arrival. There have been no warrior escorts, and yet you say she is already within the village." "She is. I receive her thoughts quite clearly. At this moment, she is pleased with the joke she has played on you, and she is convinced that my father, Lusu, has accused you falsely." "Where is she? Has she made herself invisible?" "No, no, no. Tell me, uncle, how many visitors are staying the night with us?" "Oh, they are well over 100 children, men, women, both young and old." "Well, the great one has come as a common visitor. You must have all the visitors come to your great hut, and there I will pick her out for you." Over 100 guests gathered in Mutengo's courtyard. Mutengo took his blind niece by the hand and walked with her as he greeted each guest in the circle. He took notice of how many of them shrank with revulsion as the little hunchback child approached. He saw it and smiled. If they only knew. For him, this child was the equivalent of 10 so-called normal human beings. Led by gifts beyond comprehension, Nonikwe walked with her uncle as they made their way towards the old man and his daughter. The child knelt down beside the girl, who removed her head covering that she'd worn as a gesture of respect. Immediately, Mutengu recognized his queen, despite the fact that she had shaved her head and improvised a scar with a piece of fish bladder. Mutengu gently pulled off the scar, and the great, mischievous eyes of Marimba smiled softly at him. "My queen," he said, "what is the meaning of this joke you have played? I had heard that you were corrupt and vicious and had broken every tribal law that had been laid down. I wanted to see for myself. I am glad to say that I found all of these accusations to be false and groundless." The assembled villagers and visitors fell on their faces in Marimba's presence, and the silence that descended was as thick as a skin blanket. "Oh, come, arise, arise, my people, and let us eat, and we will dance to thank our gracious host for his generosity." Then, turning to Mutengu, she asked, "How did you know about my arrival?" "Ah," he said, "this child here, with her God-given sight, she told me." "Ah," said Marimba, "I have heard of this child and her gentle spirit. What a gift she is to us all. I shall give her something to remember me by, and something that will cause others to always think of her. And when I have unseated her evil father in the village across the river, I shall appoint another to take his place until she reaches the appropriate age. Your niece will then become the head woman of the village of her birth. If she is anything like you, she, along with her great gifts, will remain as a chieftainess for the rest of her life." That announcement was greeted with a roar of applause. Men stood and extended their right hand in salute to Nonikwe, head woman for life of a village and district. Then, into the hands of Nonikwe, Marimba pressed a brand new instrument of music she had invented. It was a hand balafone, a mukimbe made entirely of reeds. She had been wanting to create something that produced a healing sound to soothe those who were weak or sick or blind. Just a few days prior, she had gone into the hospitals and sick beds and played the sweet, bird-like, soothing tones of the mukimbe. At that time, when the instrument was made with bulrush reeds and bark woven together like a raft, it was left to dry for 10 hours. It was then, so they say, that as the strips became taut, the spirit of the music entered into them. You know this instrument today as the thumb piano. Among the Wakambi, it acquired the name Sick One's Comforter. Nonikwe was overjoyed. She held the instrument close to her heart and cried as if her soul would melt. "Don't cry so. We are all going to see to it that you will never want for anything and are happy for the rest of your life. Now come, my people. Let us dance before we go to sleep." Marimba's creation was duplicated, and the instrument found its way into villages everywhere. And still sometimes today, in the early morn, the quiet of the afternoon, or the still of the night in the land of the Wakambi, you will hear the soothing notes of the mukimbe. Those who are sick, those who are lame, those who are blind, physically deformed, or sick in mind and spirit, say that they can still hear Nonikwe play, although she has long since passed from the earth. They say she comes and plays her mukimbe in their dreams. The soothing sounds diminish their infirmities and causes their spirits to rise.
There's more to come on A Season's Griot from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to A Season's Griot on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Madafo. Beverly Fields Burnett is our poet in residence.
Divine purpose, a half millennium interrupted. In the colonial days of old, when the fishermen, the hunters, and the gatherers on the Rice and Gold Coast saw the big fish, with its huge white sails approach, they put down their nets and the tools of their harvest to watch the strange onboarding. Their purpose and their mission had always been to keep the peace, the order, and the tranquility of their land, to make their tools of iron, to trade and barter with neighboring tribes, to plant groundnuts and coffee, and to grow rice as their specialty. But in a heartbeat, as they stared in an unsuspecting way, they were apprehended and taken aboard the big fish with the white sails and were stolen away, never to touch the fertile soil of their homeland again, were swiped away to a distant place to take on a new purpose, not their own. But now, in this present time, the modern villagers call themselves by new names, yet still invoke the old. They are no longer fettered by metal shackles that bound them for 400 years to someone else's plan, rule, regulation, and purpose. Today they cry out for understanding, for humane regard for their unhealed past agony and injury. Still, the struggles of these recent times seem to cast them backward, and they hide quickly their wrist so they'd not be caught up again in the same ropes and nets of their ancestors. In this modern era, the sturdy lineage of those early Rice Coast villages strives and survives in this present-day domicile. They're determined contemporary minds and motivations reach out to share their purpose with a tenacity that still strives in the hearts and minds of elders, hypnotic, imperative, and insistent. Their purpose stands tall and mighty like the oak and fertile like the roots of the baobab tree. They long to place their once sequestered purpose in tall gold vases for all to see, and to bring them into their regal kente cloth parlors, that these new descendants might learn wise ancient lessons and discover the why and the how of their purpose, then realize that the when of our divine purpose is now.
Joyce Greer loves telling this story. You can tell, just listen to her. The Little Red Hen and the Crocodile.
Now you have to imagine that I'm a fat red chicken. And I was scratching and pecking and eating fat bugs and worms on the riverbank. But in the river nearby, I saw this crocodile and he was floating in the water and looking at me. I kept eating, pecking, scratching, watching him, ready to run. And after a while, he shot up out of that water, and he said, "I'm gonna eat you up." And I started backing up, and I said, "No, brother, please don't threaten me. Brother Crocodile, I'm just eating the fat bugs and worms here on the bank. That's not your food. Please don't threaten me." I was backing up as I talked, and then I turned, and I was running away from him, afraid. And I look for food other places. Those crocodiles can run real fast on those little short legs. I was afraid to go back. Well, all the time I was gone, that big old crocodile floated in the water. And he floated in that water thinking about what I'd said to him. And he kept saying to himself, "She called me brother. I'm not in her family. We can't be related. She can't even swim." I'm related to animals that can swim. Chicken can't even swim. I'm related to turtles and frogs and ducks. Animals that can swim. He started thinking, that big crocodile, maybe she knows something I don't know. She keeps calling me brother crocodile. Maybe she knows we're related and I don't know it. Oh, I wouldn't want to eat her up if we're family. You don't want to eat up your family. I need to find out if I'm related to that chicken. I'll go to the Earth Mother. She knows everything. I'll go to the Earth Mother, and I'll find out if I'm related to that chicken. And so that big crocodile came up out of that river water and climbed up on the bank. And then he started up the road, headed for the Earth Mother's house. And on the way there, he said hi to Lizard. And Lizard said good morning to him. And they started talking. And the crocodile explained to the lizard, "I'm going to the Earth Mother because this fat chicken called me brother 2 times. And I just know we can't be related. We can't be family, but I want to know for sure." And the lizard listened to the crocodile's story and then finally wanted to know, "Why do you think you're not related to that chicken?" And the crocodile answered, "She can't swim. She can't swim. I just know I'm related to animals that can swim, animals that live in water. That chicken doesn't live in water, and she can't swim." And the lizard thought about it for a second, and then he said, "Well, it seems to me, Brother Crocodile, that you're just looking at differences. You can't just look at how you're different from that chicken. We're each born wonderfully different. It's supposed to be that way. And I'm thinking that you have some things in common with that chicken, at least one thing that comes to mind." "What? What?" the crocodile wanted to know. "What would I have in common with a chicken?" And the lizard answered, "Well, let's look at it like this, Brother Crocodile. You can swim and you lay eggs. And turtles can swim and turtles lay eggs. And frogs can swim and frogs lay eggs. Well, the chicken can't swim, but the chicken lays eggs." And the crocodile thought about that and said, she lays eggs. I hadn't thought about that. I love to watch my little crocodiles hatch out of the eggshells and crawl down to the river to swim for the first time. I love laying eggs. Oh, she lays eggs. Oh, we have that in common. I was just looking at how I was different from that chicken, huh? And the lizard said, "You can't do that. We're each born wonderfully different, and that's the way it's supposed to be." And so that crocodile thanked the lizard and turned around and headed back to the river and slid into the water and floated and floated and waited for weeks before I'd built up my courage and came tipping back to the riverbank. I was pecking and scratching and eating and watching him, ready to run. And he was watching me. He was floating there in the water, but after a time I noticed he wasn't licking his lips. And then, very slowly, he eased up out of the water. And I started to run away, but he said, "No, stay, sister." And I said, "Sister, you're calling me sister?" And he nodded his big head. He said, "Aren't we all brothers and sisters living on this earth?" And I said, "Yes, yes. I knew that. I knew that. But you were threatening me, and I thought you didn't know it." And the crocodile dropped his big head and said, "I was just looking at how we were different. But Lizard taught me an important lesson. He told me we're each born wonderfully different, and it is supposed to be that way. And Lizard taught me we each look different on the outside, but we all have a lot in common."
Bejalaba, skudumene skrela, udugululu voyevitikene laje wo. The young boy went and sat with his grandfather. He said, "Grandfather, is it true that the lion is the king of the jungle?" "Yes, my son, this is true," said the old man. "But tell me, young one, why do you ask such a question?" "Well, grandfather, in all of the books I read and all of the stories I hear, man will always defeat the lion. So how can lion be king?" The old man smiled a smile of understanding and wisdom. Then with a sigh, he said, "It will always be that way, my son, until the lion tells his own story."
On behalf of everyone here at WHQR and A Season's Griot, we thank you for listening. Thanks to wonderful storytellers Baba Jamal Karam, Charlotte Blake Alston, Alicia Minter, and Joyce Greer. Thanks also to our poet-in-residence Beverly Fields Burnett, Mario Jeter, and singer Angela Jeter. Thanks to the Robin Strauss Agency Incorporated for permission to use an adaptation of the story Nonikwe and the Great One Marimba in Indaba My Children by Vusamuzulu Credo Mutwa, published by Grove 1999, copyright 1964 by Vusamuzulu Credo Mutwa. A Season's Griot is written, directed, and hosted by Madafo Lloyd Wilson. Be sure your book